From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The comedy improv group The Groundlings isn't quite as famous as some of its alumni, like Phil Hartman, Lisa Kudrow, Julia Sweeney, John Lovitz, Will Ferrell, Chris Kattan, and Paul Rubens. Rubens created his character Pee-wee Herman when he was a member of the group. The Groundlings is celebrating its 30th anniversary. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the founder, Gary Austin, and former member, Cheryl Hines. She now plays Larry David's wife on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Snakebite, Blacktop Ballads and Fugitive Songs, the new CD by Stan Ridgway. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. American troops have moved into a second section of the Iraqi city of Fallujah. It appears to be the second prong of the U.S. attack on the rebel-controlled city. Witnesses say U.S. tanks and Humvees are now pushing into the northeastern and northwestern parts of Fallujah after pounding suspected rebel positions with fire from artillery and warplanes. NPR's Philip Reeves says the offensive is backed up by Iraqi government troops.
Throughout this, the U.S. military has been keen to present an Iraqi face on the offensive and on the operations. It's all part of an effort to try to bolster the legitimacy of the government that is in place in readiness for the elections, which are due before the end of January.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told reporters today that the offensive is part of a process that will clear the way for democracy in Iraq.
And over time, you'll find that the process of tipping will take place, that more and more of the Iraqis will be angry about the fact that their innocent people are being killed by the extremists, a number of them from outside the country, and they won't like it, and they'll want elections.
The top U.S. commander in Iraq says as many as 15,000 U.S. and Iraqi troops are now surrounding Fallujah. U.S. military officials in Baghdad say rebels attacked two churches and a hospital in the Iraqi capital today, killing at least six people and injuring more than 50 others. The two churches, less than a mile apart, were apparently hit by car bombs. Rebels also fired mortar rounds at police cars parked outside a Baghdad hospital. As Yasser Arafat lies critically ill, a highly public battle has broken out between senior Palestinian officials and the 75-year-old leader's wife, Suha Arafat. She has accused a high-level Palestinian delegation of conspiring to usurp his power and bury him alive. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Jerusalem.
The PLO's number two, Mahmoud Abbas, Prime Minister Ahmed Correa, and Foreign Minister Nabil Shaath flew to France in a bid to end the uncertainty surrounding news of Yasser Arafat's health. For the past week, confusion has reigned over contradictory reports that have claimed Arafat is in a reversible coma to Israeli press reports that say he would soon be pronounced clinically dead. In a scathing attack, Arafat's wife, Suha, accused senior Palestinian officials of rushing to push Arafat aside. A Paris resident, Suha has jealously guarded information on her husband's condition, a move that is protected by French law but deeply resented by many Palestinians. With Suha Arafat restricting access to her husband, the stage is set for a showdown with the Palestinian delegation. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
This is NPR News in Washington. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 3 points to close at 10,391 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained a fraction of a point to close at 2039. A consumer safety group is asking the federal government to label tires with expiration dates. Jerome Vaughn has more from Detroit Public Radio.
Safety Research and Strategies Incorporated has sent its request for tire dating to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The consumer group says rubber can begin to degrade after several years, even on tires that have never been used. But officials for the Rubber Manufacturers of America say there's no research to support that claim. They add that expiration dates could wrongly convince consumers that newer tires are safer, regardless of wear and maintenance issues. NHTSA officials say they have not yet reviewed the consumer group's request. The government has taken taken more interest in tire safety since Firestone recalled more than 14 million tires back in 2000. Tread separation problems on those tires have been linked to at least 271 fatalities in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
The government says it will appeal a federal judge's ruling that stopped legal proceedings against one of the prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Salim Ahmed Hamdan was scheduled to go before a military tribunal on December 7th. And the 34-year-old from Yemen is a former driver for al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The judge said Hamdan's status must first be determined by a competent tribunal. The Bush administration maintains that he's not a prisoner of war and isn't entitled to protection under the Geneva Conventions. Hamdan has said he was never a member of al-Qaeda and only worked for bin Laden as a driver and mechanic. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Vanguard Group, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Groundlings, the Los Angeles-based comedy improv group, which launched the careers of many now famous actors. Here's just a few of them.
I'm actor Troy McClure. You might remember me from such TV series as Buck Henderson, Union Buster, and Troy and Company's Summertime Smile Factory. But I'm here to tell you about Spiffy, the 21st century stain remover. Let's meet the inventor.
Margarita, I want you.
Mr. Devereaux, I can't work under these conditions.
Have it your way, baby. You're fired.
So, see, America, there's nothing to fear. Everything's fine. You go out and buy your new cars and fly on airplanes and invest in Kmart. Don't listen to what the economists say. Why? Because they like math. And math is very much a part of the axis of evil.
Morning, boys and girls.
Getting ready for my pajama party. Pajama party is where you invite all your friends over to spend the night.
And everyone has to wear their pajamas.
Oh, I cannot believe those two.
They thought that they could mess with us. They're trying to mess with us. They don't know that we know they know we know.
No, you are not wearing that.
What? Why?
You're not wearing jeans to this party.
What? These are not jeans. They're corduroy pants.
It's the same thing in a blue sweatshirt and a black jacket. No.
Oh, blue and black? That's no good?
That's no good. You need to change.
Since when is blue and black no good?
Trust me on this one, please.
That was Phil Hartman, John Lovitz, Will Ferrell, Paul Rubens, Lisa Kudrow, and Cheryl Hines. Some of the other actors who got their start on The Groundlings are Julia Sweeney, Anna Gasteyer, Chris Kattan, Kathy Griffin, Sherry O'Terry, and Lorraine Newman. In Los Angeles Magazine, The Groundlings was recently described as the premier West Coast comedy talent pool that casting directors regularly dip into to fill spots on Saturday Night Live, Mad TV, Comedy Central programs, reality shows, and sitcoms. My guests are Gary Austin, the founder of The Groundlings, and former member Cheryl Hines, who is now best known for her role as Larry David's wife on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. She co-hosted the Groundlings' 30th anniversary gala last month, which honored Gary Austin. This Wednesday, as part of the Groundlings' ongoing four-month celebration, Austin directs an evening called Best of the 70s, featuring original Groundling members performing their favorite sketches. Austin started the group after leaving the comedy group The Committee. He left the Groundlings in 1979. He's continued to teach improv and acting in Los Angeles. I spoke with Austin and Hines about improvisational comedy and their own careers. What I'd like to know from both of you is, you know, it seems like improv would be such a hard thing to teach or such a hard thing to learn. So I'd love to hear from each of you about the process of teaching or learning improv. Gary, let's start with you. Like, what can you do to actually teach improv?
Improvisation is following impulses, physical impulses. If I have an impulse to touch the other actor, I do that. If I have an impulse to cross the room, I do that. If I have an impulse to change my voice and speak in a different rhythm or pitch, I do that. So that I discover the character by following impulses and committing also to arbitrary choices. All of a sudden, Larry David is a good example of somebody who makes arbitrary choices, off-the-wall things that he says, for instance. And so I make an arbitrary choice, and follow impulses. And in doing those two things, I discover the character. I don't define a character before I play the character. I don't work well that way. I find I create better characters by discovering them as I play them.
What you've just described sounds like a child out of control, somebody who's following all their impulses and making arbitrary choices.
One of the things that I tell all actors is I'm teaching you how to be children again. I don't have to teach children. I teach children all the time. I don't have to teach them how to improvise. They already know how. And we all did when we were kids. All I have to do with a child is say, here's the premise. Do this. Here's the premise. Go. Or here's the game. Here are the rules. And then they do it. It's amazing what I don't have to say to children that I do have to say to adults.
And Cheryl Hines, from your point of view, mm-hmm. what were some of the best things that you learned about improv through classes?
I learned not to edit myself. I learned not to think about, is this going to be funny or good or interesting? So you have to learn how to let that go, which is very difficult. Actually, I taught at the Groundlings for a while, too, and it is hard. Sometimes, especially the more training you've had in theater and acting, sometimes it's very hard to let that go, to not worry about what you're going to say and, you know, worry if it's going to be good or not. So you have to let that go. Also, you know, your question is interesting because you can teach people the ideas of improv and how to make good choices in improv and how to keep an improv going and things like that. But I find, and Gary, tell me what you think, I think it's, you can't really teach somebody how to be funny.
No, and I've never done that. Sometimes people call me up and they say, "I understand you have a comedy workshop," and I say, "I've never had a comedy workshop." And when I was at the Groundlings, I didn't teach comedy. We play the truth of the moment, and in playing the truth of the moment, human behavior is funny. Look at Candid Camera. People don't know they're being funny when they're on Candid Camera, and I learned that as a kid in high school. Wow, they don't know they're being funny. Look at that. Look how hard we're laughing, and look how hard they're laughing when they see it back on TV.
One of the problems with improvisation and with a lot of comedy sketches in general is that sometimes people don't know when to stop. And the sketch will just kind of go on. You got the point of the premise, and now it's just going on long past the point where it's funny or it's working. How do you know when enough is enough?
Well, the light man takes the lights out.
Really?
Well, I was the light man for the committee my first year there before I was an actor in the committee. And part of my training was learning when to take the lights out.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about the Groundlings is the improv form there is short form for the most part. They have a long form show, but the improvs are, you know, anywhere from 2 to 4 minutes. It's a long one, but you have a director standing by that blacks out the scene when it hits a high note. And if it doesn't hit a high note, then they black it out even before. if they feel it's starting to drag, they'll black it out. It doesn't help anybody to watch a long, painful improvised scene.
I like to let a scene in workshops. I like to let a scene go past the point where you would normally take the lights out, or where it reaches a high point, and let the actors discover and struggle and find a way through and find. To make arbitrary choices or to completely change the course of the scene and find a new direction. And I found that some of the best scenes we've ever created are not the first part of the scene that we would have been great in a show, but the second part of the scene where we've gone past the point where it's already died maybe, and we have sort of out of desperation, we've already lost in a way, so there's nothing left to lose. So we really start to explore and take risks, and that's usually... Often, when the best stuff happens.
That's true. That's so interesting because it is different when you're improvising in class and you do that. And that's when you really learn as an actor. You feel like all your choices are exhausted. And so now what? And you really have to force your imagination to just, you know, come up with the next thing. And like Gary said, it's usually the more interesting choice. So once you go through those classes and you start to learn, you know, that choice is all right, that choice is all right, that choice is all right. But that choice is really fun and out in the left field, and that's what will be interesting. That's why when you go to a show at the Groundlings, usually the people that are up there performing, well, they've all been through all the classes at the Groundlings, and they quickly go to that place. But when you're going through the classes, it's a great exercise, and it's a great learning experience to push past that. You know, a lot of times in class, as a teacher there, I always tell my students, you're not here to be entertained. So, you know, we're not here to entertain each other. We're here to learn. So don't, sometimes the improvs are going to be long and boring, and you're just going to have to act like you like it.
One thing that I say to students at the end of an improv is, what did you do that you liked? And when they start to tell me what they did that they didn't like, I say, I don't want to hear that. Let's hear what you liked that you did. Because the more you focus on what you did that you liked, the more you'll do what you like.
My guests are Gary Austin, founder of the improv comedy group The Groundlings, and Cheryl Hines, a former member. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. The Los Angeles-based comedy improv group The Groundlings is celebrating its 30th anniversary. My guests are Cheryl Hines, a former groundling who is now best known for her role as Larry David's wife on HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Gary Austin, the founder of The Groundlings. I asked him about his background.
Although you came up in theater, and you've been in theater your whole adult life, you were raised in the Nazarene church where I think there was more or less a ban on seeing movies. And so you saw, what, like three movies during your childhood?
I saw a Western in the south part of Texas near the Mexican border, Mercedes, Texas. I saw an Abbott and Costello film at a birthday party in Corpus Christi, Texas, in someone's living room. And I saw The Wizard of Oz. And when Dorothy walked through the door after the house landed from the tornado in the Land of Oz and opened that door to Technicolor, and I had never seen colored film before, except our home movies, I saw that. But the other three movies were black and the other two movies were black and white. That was a very magic moment for me, and I'll never forget it. But we weren't allowed to see films, and some of the stricter people in the Nazarene Church, the women weren't allowed to cut their hair or wear short sleeves or wear makeup or jewelry. It was a very restrictive time in my life, of course, and I created a show, which I've done around the country, a solo show called Church, which is based on that time in my life. But I learned how to act initially by watching preachers. My God, evangelists, what great actors they were. And some of them were sincere. I think most of the ones I grew up with were sincere. Some of them, I think, weren't. But in either case, they were brilliant actors. They used their bodies. They used their voices. And I believe, well, I know that in all my work that I've done as an artist, in all my teaching and all my work myself as an actor, I've always emphasized physical work, completely committing to being present physically, alive in your body, in the moment. And I really believe that if you go to a Groundling show, you'll see very, very physical work going on the stage. And I really trace my approach to the art of acting back to those early days of watching preachers.
Your father worked for Halliburton when you were growing up.
His entire life.
And this was in Oklahoma when you were young, and then I guess he was transferred to California?
Well, Texas and then California.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up in Odessa, Texas for two years of my childhood, 20 miles from George W. Bush in Midland, who was growing up there at the same time. Most of my Texas years were in Corpus Christi down on the Gulf Coast, and we lived in Halliburton camps. One summer before my senior year in college, I worked for Halliburton myself for $2.74 an hour at the Halliburton oil camp in Santa Fe Springs, California.
So what's it like for you to see Halliburton so in the news?
I have a show called Oil, which I'm opening officially at the Groundlings in January, on January 10th. I've been doing it in bits and pieces all over the country for a couple of years. it's amazing to me that what was kind of, well, when I was called a Halliburton kid. Everybody, if your father worked for Halliburton, you were called a Halliburton kid by everybody in the town you lived in. And so when I would, you know, was older and would mention Halliburton to people, they wouldn't know what I was talking about. So it's amazing to me to be able to say the word Halliburton now and have everybody's eyes widen and look at me and go, my God, I know what you're talking about.
And the meaning Halliburton kid probably has a different meaning now than it did when you were young.
Yes, it does. Yes.
So, okay, you grew up in a community that doesn't want children watching or anybody watching movies. Then your family moves to Los Angeles, where it's the movie capital of the world. So
right.
Were you still not allowed to see movies at that point?
Right. Well, and my parents began to get more liberal. And when I was in high school, I started seeing movies then. And then, of course, you know, and then that went away. I stopped going to the Nazarene Church. Actually, I transferred to the Baptist Church. I had a Christian psychologist who told my parents to take me out of the Nazarene Church when I was 11 or 12 because I was so terrified that I was going to burn in hell that I had shrunk. At the age of 12, I weighed 55 pounds. And after going to the Christian psychologist, I gained 20 pounds in 4 weeks because she put me at peace and said, you know, you can rest. Everything's going to be fine. You don't have to worry about going to hell. You're not going to go there. And she had my parents transfer me to a Baptist church. But then when I went to college in San Francisco, I stopped going to church altogether. The theater became my church.
Cheryl Hines, how did you end up joining the Groundlings?
Well, I had moved out here from Florida, and I was bartending at a hotel downtown. And I met one of Phil Hartman's sisters at the bar. She was staying in the hotel, and she started saying that she wanted to go to this theater called The Groundlings on Melrose, because that's where her brother got his start. And when I found out it was Phil Hartman, and at that time he was on SNL, something clicked over, like, oh, that's how you go from Tallahassee, Florida to SNL. You just go to The Groundlings. No, I didn't figure it was that easy, but I thought there must be something great about that theater if that's where Phil Hartman got a start. So I immediately went to a show as soon as I had a night off, and I was blown away by what I saw on the stage there. And at that time, I didn't even have a refrigerator because it was so broke. And I so wanted to take classes at the Groundlings, and I couldn't afford it. And every day I would come into work, and I would talk about the Groundlings, and that's all I talked about. And for my birthday, all of the people I worked with and the regulars that came in all chipped in to buy my first class at the Groundlings.
Oh, that's so nice. Were you a waitress?
I was a bartender, yeah.
Bartender, yeah. Oh, that's mm-hmm. that's really, really nice. So
it was great.
How'd you pay for your second class?
I cried a lot. Well, I continued to talk to the regulars and tell them how I was growing as an actress and how it was important for them to tip me well. And what's really interesting is I ended up meeting Phil backstage at the Groundlings a few years later. And it was, you know, a magical moment. He just walked by and said a few funny words, and I was certain that that's where I was supposed to be at that moment.
Now, was your ambition to be on Saturday Night Live?
It was, yeah. It was a dream. You know, it was, I always watched it growing up, and I felt like that's the type of thing that I wanted to do. But even going through school, you know, you take theater classes and acting classes, but nothing like what they're doing on the stage for SNL. So I never really understood how those people learned how to do that. Because I was going to acting class and they weren't doing that.
Well, working on Saturday Night Live was a dream that never came true.
That's true.
Did you audition?
I never did. I never had the chance to audition. Mm-mm. Although I did, I auditioned for Mad TV about 1,000 times. And right before I got Curb Your Enthusiasm, I had auditioned for Mad again, and they were very interested. And they told me, you know, don't say yes to anything else before you talk to us. And they didn't cast me. And I was sure my career was over at that point.
What was your audition like for Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Well, I had an audition that was scheduled. They called me about an hour before my audition and said, you know what, we're really running behind. We're going to have to postpone your audition. And that, you know, is kind of Hollywood speak for you're not coming in. Which at the time was okay with me because, you know, I didn't really know who Larry David was. I knew he created Seinfeld, and that's exciting. But I didn't, none of it really registered like this was going to be a huge, big thing. It was an hour special on HBO. So, yes, it would be very cool if he got it. From the description of the wife, you know, the part that I went in for, I didn't think I was right for it. So when they told me that I wasn't going in, I was okay. And that night, I was doing sketch comedy. It wasn't at the Groundlings, but it was material that I created at the Groundlings. And the director and the producer of the Curb Your Enthusiasm special they were both at the show that night, and they saw one of the sketches that I had written and I performed it, and they thought that my sense of humor kind of matched up with Larry's, and they called me in the next morning. And I had never met Larry before. I walked into the room. I didn't know, they didn't tell me anything about the audition because it was all improvised. I walked in, I met Larry. We started improvising a scene, and then we did a few more. And they called me about 3 or 4 hours later and told me I got the job.
Gary Austin is the founder of the Groundlings. Cheryl Hines is a former member. She'll talk more about her life and career in the second half of the show. The Groundlings' 30th anniversary celebration continues at the Groundlings Theater in Los Angeles through January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, on the web at alz.org. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sickened, The True Story of a Lost Childhood, a memoir by Munchausen by proxy survivor Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Cheryl Hines. She co-stars in HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Snakebite, Blacktop Ballads and Fugitive Songs, the new CD by Stan Ridgway. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. She started her career performing with the comedy improv group The Groundlings, which is now celebrating its 30th anniversary with a four-month-long series of performances at the Groundlings Theater in Los Angeles. Hines gets to use a lot of her improv skills on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Here's a scene from last season. Larry and Cheryl David are having a ceremony to renew their wedding vows. Cheryl wants Larry to work on his vows. Cheryl has already started working on hers.
So this is what I have so far. May I always have the wisdom to look past your shortcomings and appreciate all of the goodness you possess. We promise to continue loving each other unconditionally, not only throughout this lifetime, but after death through all eternity. We stand before you.
What? Was that about eternity?
We will love each other throughout this lifetime, but after death through all eternity.
You mean this is continuing into the afterlife?
Yeah, that's the idea. Do you have a problem with that?
Well, I thought this was over at death. I didn't know we went into eternity together. Isn't that what it said in Till Death Do Us Part? I thought it was...
Do you have a problem with eternity?
Well...
We finally found each other, Larry, and we're celebrating this for all eternity.
I guess I had a different plan for eternity. I thought I'd be single, I guess.
I'm sorry. I'm interrupting your single life in eternity?
No, I just didn't realize that this relationship carried over after death.
Well, it does. It carries over.
So I guess I just took that for
granted. Okay. Do you not want to renew our vows because...
No, I want to renew our vows until, you know, I didn't... Can we take out the eternity part?
No.
Okay.
When we left off, we were talking about how Cheryl Hines got her part on Curb Your Enthusiasm. What was the audition like? You said that you had to improvise a scene with Larry David. What did they tell you about your character and about his character?
They told me, you know, about the audition, they told me that, you know, with the part of Larry's wife, doesn't put up with a lot of bull, that she's heard it all from him before, and she stands up to him, basically. So that's all they told me. And I went in, and at that point, they were thinking that we were going to have kids on the show, which in the special, we did. I bet you never saw them, but we talked about them. But anyway, so my first scene that I did with them, we were just sitting next to each other, and he said, I don't think you put enough milk in the kid's cereal bowl. He said, I don't understand why you can't just fill it all the way up to the top. And I said, well, there's no reason to. You know, if you cover the flakes, they're fine. And then you give them a glass of milk if they want to drink the milk. He's like, yeah, but we can afford it. Why don't we just go ahead and fill it up all the way? I said, because there's no point in it. There's just milk that sits left over and it goes to waste. And he's like, well, why don't you just try it? So it was really one of those. And then we did another scene where he told me that he wasn't going to eat chicken. That's all he told me. And then he goes, okay, so let's, you know, we'll improvise a scene. And he asked me what we were having for dinner, you know, and I said that we were having potatoes and green beans and chicken. And he said, I just told you I'm not eating chicken. And I said, well, so the rest of your family doesn't get to eat chicken? I said, you don't have to eat the chicken. Every time you say you're not going to do something, we don't do it. It'll be, you know, we can't live like that. Because you're neurotic, we're not going to have to live our lives like that. So don't eat the chicken. But he was like, he couldn't believe that I said that we were going to have chicken after he just told me that he wasn't eating chicken anymore. So we laughed a lot, actually, in that audition.
So I guess you had the personality they were looking for.
Well, they said that they were kind of running into people that were either... too pushy and too confrontational, or as soon as he got confrontational, they would back off and their feelings would get hurt. So So I guess I was a happy medium. I don't know.
So how does improvisation and how does all the work that you did with the Groundlings figure in now to your work on Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David?
Well, I'm sure that I would not have this job if I didn't have my training at the Groundlings because, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm is all improvised. We get a story outline that's about 8 or 9 pages long, and then all the dialogue is improvised. So before I came to the Groundlings, I had not had any improv training, only in acting classes for, an exercise, maybe. They would say, do something improvised. But it was never meant to be funny, and it was never comedy. So the Groundlings really helped me to understand what improv is all about. Now, while I'm saying this, I can imagine Larry David listening to this interview going, it's not so hard. But that's what he thinks about acting. He always thinks that people that have had training act like it's all so hard, and it's not so hard. He always says, you know, if you're supposed to have a stomach ache, you act like you have a stomach ache. It's not so hard. You grab your stomach and moan.
Of course, he's playing himself, more or less.
Yeah, of course. Exactly. So I'm sure if he heard me talking about improv and how, you know, it's good to be trained, he would be making fun of me. But
that's what you want in a co-star, isn't it? Someone who can make fun of you.
Yes. But listen, I get mocked at every turn, I have to tell you. Going back to the question, yes, I would not have felt comfortable going into that audition, I think, if I hadn't had training at the Groundlings, because it seems it can be intimidating, improvising, especially coming from a theater background where they tell you that it's all about what's on the page and what other characters say about you in the script and what your character says in the script, and you analyze every word and every motivation. So in theater, for me anyway, that's where you start. You start with the script. So to all of a sudden be in a theater and you don't have a script, it's a strange place.
What were your first impressions of your character on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and how do you think that character has changed, or how do you think your impressions of her have changed?
Well, you know, certainly she's seen Larry do it all, and she can't get too invested in what he's doing or saying. Or she'd be a, you know, basket case. So I don't know how it's evolved through the years. I think maybe the characters, the audience has been able to see a bit of a lighter side of her. You know, she does find Larry funny. I think that's Larry's saving grace in the show. Is she really does find him funny, but highly annoying.
Yes, well, I'm sure you've had to ask yourself, why does your character stay married to him on the show when he's so inconsiderate and so tone deaf to the needs of other people, including his wife?
Well, she stays married to him because, well, first of all, she really does love him, and she finds him very entertaining. And, you know, that is true. Larry David doesn't come along every day. He's an unusual person in real life and on the show. And I can understand how in real life someone would be married to someone like Larry David, because he's intelligent. He sees the world through a different lens, which is fascinating to witness. So I can understand it.
Now, have you met Larry David's real wife?
I have.
How does she compare to the character you play as his wife?
That's a good question, because I haven't spent very much time with Larry David. I really just sort of run into her. It sounds awful to say, but at award shows. It sounds very pretentious, doesn't it? but they're two different people. You know, people always ask me if I'm doing an impersonation of Larry's real wife. And when the show started, I had not even met her. So we had started shooting this special before I even met her. So I don't really know how I compared to her. I imagine that we're pretty different. But I imagine on some levels, there's probably the same dynamic going on. I imagine in real life, he probably is a little annoying, but really funny.
My guest is Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. She got her start with The Groundlings, the comedy improv group, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Cheryl Hines. She plays Cheryl David, Larry David's wife, on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. Well, what is one of the more surprising moments that came out of improvising on Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Oh, dear. I feel like every time we shoot a scene, I am surprised. You know, it's probably... Sometimes there's a scene that wasn't in the story outline that just evolves. And there was a scene in one of the episodes when we're talking about a terrorist attack on Los Angeles. And I wanted Larry to stay in town and he wanted to get out of town. And we ended up doing this scene where, you know, as a wife, I said, don't you think we should go together if something does happen? And he says, not necessarily. And I said, well, and he goes, don't you think that's being a little selfish? I said, what are you going to do if you leave town and I'm in town? What are you going to do? And one of the takes that didn't make it into the show, but every time we did the scene, he would say something different. And one of the takes, he said he was going to go to a dude ranch. While I was in town getting bombed. So it's moments like that that surprise me. And I spend most of my drive home just laughing to myself. What a crazy job I have.
What's it like to work with him?
It's like going to summer camp when you're 13. And... Or it's like, you know, when you're in high school and you go into chemistry class and everybody gets paired up for lab partners. And it's like I got paired up with the smartest, dorkiest guy in class. And then you realize quickly into it that you're having the best time and that he knows all the answers. So that's kind of how it feels for me anyway.
Have you ever been absolutely speechless by something that he said?
Well, I have been, and if you watch the show, you'll see several times where I don't even know what to say to him. It takes me a while to process what he just told me. Sometimes I'll just be like, you know, why would you tell someone that, why would you congratulate them on his son having a big penis? It's like, that. Why would that come out of your mouth? So there are moments like that where I just have to process it before I can respond to it. So I'm mostly just asking why.
But you're processing it in character.
Yes, I have to process it in character, yes.
And is that something that improv taught you to do, to process something in character as opposed to process it as yourself and then figure out, now, what would the character do?
Yes, it definitely... taught me that, the training in improv. Because when you're improvising, you don't have time to think. You mostly have time to respond, really. I mean, so when you do a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm or any show that's improvised, you have to go into the show knowing who your character is so you can respond as that character without overthinking it or thinking at all what you're going to say. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what you have to do.
Have you, because you've played the part of Cheryl David so long, and because the part is improvised so often, mm-hmm. do you feel like you sometimes go through life as her and imagine how she would be responding?
Only when I'm with Larry. Only when I'm hanging out with him socially. You know, if we're, I don't know what we might be doing. Now I've conjured up thoughts of us like hanging out watching a Dodgers game, which we don't. But if for some reason we're someplace together and I will, like someone will come up and start talking to him and reminiscing with him about something that they did, and he'll just look at him and go, "What's your name?" So then I have to, you know, have a talk with them. I'm like, "Larry, you don't just blurt out what's your name to someone who obviously knows you." You know, he's like, "Well, why not?" It's because it's rude, for starters. He's like, "Well, if you don't know their name, I go, there are other ways to do it, you know." So, yeah, I do find myself reacting as Cheryl David sometimes.
That's so funny. I feel like we know so much, or those of us who watch the show know so much about you as Larry David's wife on the show. But tell us something about yourself, about where you grew up, what your family was like.
I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. I grew up in Florida. I was born in Miami and lived in a little town outside of Orlando. And my whole family lives there now. And I have two brothers and a sister. You know, I grew up in kind of a small town, so my dad's, I'm not going to say redneck, but kind of. So, I mean, we grew up with not a lot of money. You know, my grandfather had orange groves, and that was our weekend, was he would drive us around his orange grove in the back of his pickup truck, and we'd run around the orange groves. So it certainly wasn't a big city experience for me.
Did you ever know anybody like Larry David before doing the show? Because I mean he is so urban. And, I mean, he's very much out of Brooklyn, very yeah. much from a Jewish family, very much
yes.
a certain type of neurotic. Did you know anyone like that?
Well, no. I had never met anyone like Larry before I walked in the room and met him that day. You know, even growing up where I grew up, I don't think I had one Jewish friend growing up. So when I moved out to Los Angeles, I started out as a, I was bartending, and then I got a job as an assistant to Rob Reiner and his family. So that was my first introduction to a Jewish family. And I sort of educated myself through that, because I would have to buy the kids like Passover coloring, Hanukkah coloring books and things like that. And so I started learning a little bit here and there about the Jewish faith. And then when I met Larry, we started shooting the show, and he was thinking that I was going to be Jewish. His wife would be Jewish. And about halfway through our first season, he looked at me and said, "I don't think anybody thinks that you're Jewish." I said, "Well, I don't know what to tell you. I'm trying." And then we decided that it would probably be funnier if I wasn't anyway. So, I had never met anybody neurotic like Larry.
I think that's what part of what makes the relationship so interesting, is that because you don't fall into predictable patterns with him, since you never knew anybody like him, there's
right.
something very kind of surprising at how you deal with him. and that works.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, my family, I grew up, it was very easygoing. Everything was easygoing. So So Lara's character on the show is the opposite of that.
Yes.
And so I'm always trying to adjust to it. But in real life, we also have that dynamic, so it's kind of an easy crossover.
Cheryl Hines plays Cheryl David, Larry David's wife, on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. She got her start with The Groundlings. The improv group is celebrating its 30th anniversary with 4 months of performances at its theater in Los Angeles. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Stan Ridgway's new album of blacktop ballads and fugitive songs. This is Fresh Air. Stan Ridgway has been recording music since the late 70s with his punk-era band Wall of Voodoo, which had a minor hit in 1982 with Mexican Radio. Based in Los Angeles, Ridgway has worked on soundtrack albums, including Francis Ford Coppola's Rumblefish, and released a number of solo albums. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Ridgway's new one, Snakebite, Blacktop Ballads and Fugitive Songs, is a concept album that coheres better than most such ambitious efforts.
Take my leave. No one will care. I'll slip away into the sun. Where the clouds are.
In Stan Ridgway's world, Los Angeles is a bad Hollywood joke, a place to escape from, preferably into the desert, some horribly hot spot where no one wants to come looking for him, where, as he says in that song, the beer cans don't talk back. Ridgway's sense of humor is as dry as his throat sounds, as dry as the desert landscapes he prefers to locate his songs, such as this chain gang horror joke called Crow Hollow Blues. Back when he led Wall of Voodoo, Ridgway got caught up in the Los Angeles version of punk rock, which was aimlessly hostile, nihilistic, punk as attitude rather than as music. This was a band, after all, formed initially to provide music for cheesy horror films. Ridgway's music has been much improved during his solo years, as he's luxuriated in the freedom to assume different characters and pick up different influences, from the blues to a very secular gospel to garrulous road songs. Listen to him speak in the voice of a larcenous crack addict in the bleakly funny King for a Day.
Yeah, I'm driving down your freeway in a brand new car that I just found. Oh, it was parked there in your driveway. Didn't want to I pushed it down the street, hopped and running, I rolled the window down. Yeah, I'm doing 95 now. I'm smoking crack, it can't be meat. And thanks for all the money you left in your wallet on the seat. It's generosity like yours that keeps us poor folk off the street. Hey, I'm doing 110.
If you look at the CD cover, you'll see that Snakebite is divided into what Ridgway calls three acts. But the structure is very loose. The first six songs are mostly about sitting around waiting for the cops to show up, or worse. The next five songs cover a lot of ground in the sense of travel, with tunes about riding the rails and a misbegotten night in Manhattan. By the time he hits Act 3, Ridgway has become intensely self-conscious, to the point of offering a version of his past called Talkin' Wall of Voodoo Blues Part 1.
Didn't want no MTV, didn't want no VH1. Was a time so long ago, yeah, we had some punk rock fun. Made a great big noise for all the girls and boys. It was 1977, now two are gone to heaven.
As the song proceeds, it turns into the usual young band gets bilked by its manager and winds up broke and exhausted from pointless touring. I do really like the couplet, "The sharks showed up and circled a big manager for Sting," even though there's not much else you haven't heard before there. But Ridgway has learned to make even his most predictable moves sound good. Self-produced mixtures of rock, blues, jazz, and yes, film mood music. Most of the time, his words are hard-boiled prose, but no tough guy writer would describe a convict's girlfriend as looking like Stubby K. Only a very smart fella can toss in a reference to a character actor best known for his role in Guys and Dolls and then rhyme him with D.A. Stan Ridgway has showbiz in his blood, and he likes to put that blood on the tracks occasionally.
Ken Tucker is the film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Snakebite, Blacktop Ballads and Fugitive Songs by Stan Ridgway.
Bobby had a background, he'd done some prison time. He borrowed a police car, drove it over the state line. His partner wore a red dress, she looked like Stubby K. And when they finally caught him, oh, she sang to the DA, throw it away.
Oh, Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Joan Tui Westman. And we welcome our new researcher, Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Skies getting darker.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Neighborhood Starbucks, collecting books and toys for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
So tell me, open, pull me out.
For the next Fresh Air, James Hetfield of the metal band Metallica. We'll talk about anger, sobriety, and going through a form of group therapy with the band that was documented in the film Some Kind of Monster. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.